Many of us know the joys and frustrations of hunting for a good parking spot. Well, imagine if your job, actually your livelihood, depended on finding that perfect spot. That's actually the case for food trucks trying to serve lunch to big city workers. The right spot can make the difference between fortune and ruin. Robert Smith with our Planet Money team rode along with a food truck in the most competitive parking city in the country, the Big Apple.
The race for the perfect parking spot starts early. And far from the skyscrapers of Manhattan, the starting line is way out here in a lot in outer Brooklyn where the food trucks sleep at night.
This is so tight and cozy.
Do I have to close this?
Yes, please.
I'm inside the rickshaw dumpling truck with co-owner Kenny Lowe. It's an old postal van painted red, now filled with steamed Chinese dumplings. All around us in this parking lot are the food truck competition. Falafel guys, grilled cheese vans, taco trucks. We're heading into the city, all looking for the same thing.
I think that there is that mystical spot in Midtown that every truck owner dreams of that is easy parking. It's a wide sidewalk. They have no restaurants, but there's lots of offices, and there's a couple of those.
As we drive into Manhattan, Kenny Lowe says this is the challenge. A couple of mystical spots, and yet there are 3,000 year-round food trucks and carts competing for those spots. And it gets more complicated. None of the spots are assigned, and yet...
We've gone to spots before where, like, the falafel guys and the shish kebab guys will come up and they're like, what's your menu? Do you sell chicken? And I was like, we sell chicken and Thai basil dumpling with Bell and Evans chicken, fresh Thai basil. And they're like, you can't sell chicken on this block. I'm the chicken guy on 52nd Street.
And sometimes it gets ugly out there. Every few months you hear about some taco truck vendor who gets into a fist fight with the chicken on a stick guy. I mean, actually throwing punches out on the sidewalk. The stakes for this business are high. A good spot on the corner can mean thousands of dollars in business. If you're stuck on a side street, it can ruin your day. Now, this is a classic economic problem. There's a scarce resource worth a lot of money. How do you keep the competition for that resource from turning into chaos? New York City could auction the best spots to the highest bidder. That's what an economist would recommend. But they don't do that. Instead, they try to regulate the mess. Before I went out on the truck, I walked the streets of New York with David Weber. He's the other owner of the rickshaw dumpling, and he just wrote the food truck handbook. He says New York has the most restrictive rules out there.
So you need to be at least 20 feet away from the subway. In addition, you can't be within 20 feet of the public entrance to any building.
Now, I can't park in front of this restaurant right here?
20 feet from the entrance to that restaurant.
Yeah, yeah. And there's like a school regulation, too.
Absolutely. I believe it's 200 feet from a school. And the principle for that is...
Ice cream trucks.
It gets even tougher out here. The NYPD has started to give out tickets for selling food from a metered parking spot. In other words, just about every inch of Manhattan.
Strictly speaking, following all the regulatory constraints that are currently enforced at this moment, there really is not any place for a food truck to park.
All these restrictions just end up forcing the trucks into even tighter competition. David Weber says when it comes down to it, food truck vendors have to police themselves through an informal code. You respect the guy who got there first. You don't park next to someone who sells the exact same thing. Because if you're a jerk, the other guy can make your day miserable. A hot dog cart, say, can block your truck window and keep you from doing any business at all. That's the law of the street.
Okay, what's going on with the parking here?
Back in the rickshaw dumpling truck, Kenny Lowe has another way to deal with all this competition. He tries to be a little smarter. He searches the city for parking spots that aren't that obvious. Maybe in cool neighborhoods with more adventurous eaters.
I love parking on sunny sides, so if I know that the sun's going to click over and be sunny right at noon in a certain area, I know that that's going to be really, really awesome versus the shady side of the street in great weather.
And an hour before lunchtime, we find it. A wide sidewalk in front of an advertising agency.
Great. Why don't you hop out?
It's a little close to a fire hydrant, but it's as near to perfect as we're going to find. Time to start cooking. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
There's nothing more American than an apple pie, right? Well, many of us would say the same thing about a good old-fashioned bake sale, selling homemade pies, cookies, muffins, Rice Krispie treats to raise cash for a school organization. Well, bake sales are now under a lot of scrutiny in the battle against childhood obesity. In the new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, food safety reporter Stephanie Armour explains the move towards banning bake sales.
States and schools have gotten very concerned because children and adolescents have a rapidly increasing obesity rate. It's tripled since 1980. So the thought is that if they can get healthier food or no bake sales, that perhaps they can lower that rate.
Well, are parents in support of this? I mean, they clearly want their kids to be healthy, but you know, I'm sure a lot of parents remember bake sales being something, you know, they cherished when they were in school.
It seems like parents are really divided. There are some that say, look, they're having these sales, my kids are coming home jacked up on sugar, and there's quite a strong contingent that say, look, the schools really need this money for things like activities and clubs, and that putting a ban or restrictions just really goes way too far.
And Stephanie, I certainly took part in a lot of bake sales in my school days, but I always wonder, I mean, how much money can a bake sale raise? What kind of cash are we talking about?
It varies. Some can raise quite a bit. One mother in New York City told me that she had raised more than $50,000.
Wow.
Fundraising efforts in one school in Maryland had raised $25,000. So it can actually be substantial, and it's really often an important component of activities, clubs. In Massachusetts, one school district raised $25,000 through fundraising sales, and that money went for things like scholarships, uniforms, as well as a brand new scoreboard for the swimming pool, an 8-lane scoreboard.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, because I suppose that a lot of these bake sales are actually funding athletics, which raises the issue that, sure, you're trying to make kids healthier by not allowing bake sales, but here they are supporting athletics and making kids healthier.
That's exactly what a number of students and the Booster Club folks said to me, that, look, we're actually raising money for things that keep kids active and keep them healthy, and that is an important focus that should not be lost.
Do some people feel this has gone overboard? I mean, I know a lot of people who deal with obesity say that it's all in moderation, and it seems to strike me here that there might be a time when you would say one home-baked, you know, cupcake or one home-baked cookie is a lot more nutritional value than, you know, a bag of Doritos or you know, candy bars every day from the vending machine.
Right. In Texas, they passed an amendment, the Safe Cupcake Amendment, which basically upholds the right of parents to bring in a cupcake or a donut for their kids on their birthday, because some of these bans also restrict treats that are on class birthdays.
This has actually reached a state legislature.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
Like a Bill of Rights saying parents have a right to celebrate their child's birthday with a cupcake.
With a cupcake in the school. And some of the parents are saying they hope to bring that fight to what is now going on with bake sales, although quite frankly, the USDA is going to come out this year with rules on what can be sold in school during the day, what kind of food, and that is expected to cover bake sales in terms of making them more nutritious, although there will be some exceptions for infrequent bake sales.
So the U.S. Department of Agriculture might find a way to bring this debate to some compromise ending.
Right, right. They're saying they're not banning bake sales, but I think a lot of people are concerned as to what kind of rules will be rolled out nationwide.
Stephanie Armour, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
It's Stephanie Armour. She is Bloomberg's food safety reporter.
Philadelphia has its cheesesteak sandwich, Buffalo its wings. Now Tampa has officially claimed the Cuban sandwich. The Tampa, Florida City Council last month passed a resolution designating the historic Tampa Cuban sandwich and specifying its ingredients. From member station WUSF in Tampa, Bobby O'Brien found that claim has drawn ridicule from Miami's Cuban community.
An authentic Tampa Cuban starts with the bread.
Tampa bread, you know that if you've eaten a piece of it, because crumbs are everywhere.
That's Andrew Hughes. He wrote the history of the Columbia, Florida's century-old Spanish-Cuban restaurant.
If you go to Miami, you're not going to find that bread. You're going to find a squishy bread.
Master only, in no press.
David Audette collected the history of Tampa's sandwich at the behest of city council. Roccato's Sandwich Shop, established in 1948, is one of his favorite lunch spots.
This is how they build it. They take the Cuban bread, cut the bread in half, then you do what's called sweet ham. You put the ham here because it has the most moisture and it's going to soak into the bread. Then this is the mojo pork, the roast pork, shredded, not sliced. So that means this has been roasted.
Add dry Swiss cheese, tangy mustard, crisp dill pickles, and Genoa salami.
If my abuela would have seen salami in a Cuban sandwich, she would do the signal of the cross and say, that's a sacrilege.
Miami Mayor Tomas Regalado dismisses Tampa's version of the Cuban.
Salami belongs in pizza and, you know, Italian restaurants.
Tampa's Latin community dates back to the 1880s. The King Corona Cafe is in a building nearly 100 years old in Ybor City, Tampa's Latin Quarter. Cafe owner Don Barco sells fine cigars, Cuban coffee, and Cuban sandwiches. He says a good Cuban is like a handmade cigar.
You have this different blending of tobaccos, and it's the same thing with the Cuban sandwich. All those different ingredients marry, and that's what gives you the flavor of the Ybor City Cuban sandwich.
Tampa's already staked a historic claim to the Cuban sandwich. Now it's aiming for the culinary title. A Cuban sandwich contest is scheduled later this month in Ybor City. Miami sandwich makers are invited. For NPR News, I'm Bobby O'Brien in Tampa.
This is NPR News. Years ago this past week, Frank and Rose Snock opened their fish restaurant in Philadelphia. A century later, Snocky's Oyster and Crab House is still serving up deep-fried fish fillets, deviled clams, and, of course, oysters. They've got as many as a dozen varieties. Today, it's the Snock's grandchildren, Ken and Skip, who are running the show. But apparently, not much else has changed. Snocky's is still making the same oyster stew that Rose cooked for 79 years. And while fancy fish recipes have acquired a certain cachet among foodies, Snocky's is sticking with its no-nonsense approach. Ken Snock told the Philadelphia Inquirer, "We don't have capers in our kitchen. There's no fennel leak reduction back there."